I'm Evan Kleinman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. A few weeks back, I scared all of us with reports of the dangers of using plastic containers for your food. Today, some alternatives. Is it possible to blend a tape measure or a hockey puck or a pack of matches? Why would you care? The man behind Will It Blend will let us know. But first, let's see what's in season at the market and check up on the farmers threatened by the recent wildfires.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're back at the market after a horrible week of fires that have been affecting a lot of our San Diego and Riverside and Ventura County farmers. And we're visiting today with Armando Garcia, who's a farmer from Deluz, which is an area of San Diego County that's near Fallbrook. And Armando, everyone was worried about you. And we actually had calls at our office, and I know KCRW got calls. You were actually evacuated. You had some very close calls. Tell us about your experience over the last week. And it started, it got really bad, what, last Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday was the worst day, but on Monday when I woke up or walked outside, it looked like somebody had shoveled sand into your driveway, and there was all the ash from overnight. By Monday evening, we were evacuated from Fallbrook. Fallbrook was just a small fire, and then by the end of the day, it was one of the biggest fires.
So you had to how much time did you have to pack up, and how much notice did you have?
They were warning everybody pretty early, yeah, all day. Just get out because of the smoke.
So you guys got out, and did you have a place to go?
We have a house in Murrieta, so we stayed in Murrieta.
Were your orchards, was anything burned?
No, we were spared, yeah. It was about a mile away.
Really?
It was the closest I got, yeah.
Wow, and so is there a lot of cleaning up to do?
Yeah, the inside of your house, clean everything. Smells like smoke.
Really?
Yeah, it smells like smoke.
So everything is kind of back to normal as much as it can be?
As much as it can be, yeah.
And what you've got today, did you have to go out in the orchards and all that soot and stuff and just pick?
Yeah.
Whatever you
got to pick, yeah. Our guys didn't work last week at all. Monday we started working.
So. And I guess the air quality was bad.
That's
so
the
people,
reason why
yeah.
people were getting evacuated as
right.
well, yeah.
And why you don't want people out picking because it wasn't healthy.
No.
Well, it's great to see you here.
Thank you for having us, yeah.
That was Armando Garcia, and he narrowly avoided having some serious damage on his farm down in Deluz, but his neighbors in Fallbrook and Temecula had some real serious losses. So it's hard all the way around for friends and neighbors, but they're back. Try to come out and see him. He's at the Wednesday market now. He'll be back at the Saturday and Sunday markets in a couple of weeks. We're happy to be starting November a little early this year with some nice Satsuma mandarins that Troy Regeer brings down from Reedley, California. Troy is well known during the summer for his wonderful peaches. And now he's back about a week ahead of schedule with some really nice seedless sweet mandarins. So a mandarin is a small seedless tangerine. I guess the names are used interchangeably. But mandarins are seedless.
Correct.
Okay.
And technically a tangerine has seeds in them. But I grew up knowing these or calling these tangerines my whole life.
But the real brand name of these is a Satsuma. Okay.
They're a Satsuma, a Wari Satsuma, and they're really, they have great flavor. They just explode inside your mouth.
I'm eating one right now. And like lots of times, Troy, you'll come down and the first week is a little more tart and a little less fully developed, but these are really good.
Yeah, we just had some weather patterns that, you know, I just can't describe. It cools off, and then it gets hot late, and, you know, it's just Mother Nature taking care of business, and it's a good year all the way around for us, so we're lucky to have them. As far as the citrus goes, everything is really loaded on the trees, so that means there's a lot of fruit on the trees this year. So it looks like it's going to be a really good year for everything.
You're going to have these probably through January months.
Yeah, you know, we're going to go through February, and last year maybe I think we went into March 1 week. So mm-hmm. we cover half the rows with plastic in a few weeks here just to protect them from the frost, and that's been working out well and enables us to go longer in the season with them. These are so, people love these. I brought some home and the kids start eating them, and that's what's good. They're easy to peel and kids love to take them in a lunch pack or something like that to school.
And how much are they?
They're $3 a pound.
Okay. And you probably get about, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 of these in a pound?
I think you get like 10 of them right now, something like that, 10 to 12.
Okay. All right. Well, they are delicious and they're so much fun to eat. So we're glad you're back and your table is loaded and we'll be getting more great stuff for the next couple of months.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be back.
Thanks, Troy. That was Troy Regeer. He has a family farm up in Reedley. He brings in peaches and nectarines in the summer, takes a short break, and now he started about a week early with these wonderful seedless Satsuma mandarins, and they are delicious. We're visiting now with Alex Weiser, who is obviously, he's the potato guy. But today, you were telling us you have these really good fresh dried beans. So what are they?
That's right. Well, our varieties are purple hull pink-eyed peas.
Okay.
I know it's a mouthful, but purple hull represents the purple shell on the outside. And inside, it's very much like a black-eyed pea, but the eye is pink rather than purple. And it has a little different flavor, a little sweeter, and people love them. Mm-hmm. And at this stage in the fall, it's a fresh, dry bean.
So it actually dries on the vine, or do you pick these and let them lie around
What we do is we just pick whatever's left on the vine. Yeah. It will be mainly dry, but there'll still be some green ones in there. Mm-hmm. Though they're dry, they're not like the ones you get in the market that are dry, years dry. These have just been dried on the shelf, so they still cook in an hour. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be soaked.
And so, Alex, they're in the purple shell, the hull right here, and so I'm going to get probably a couple pounds of those, and then I got to shell them all.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I have some that we shelled.
Uh-huh.
But and how we do it, and people can do this at home, is just when they're dry, just put them in a pillowcase and just bang on the pillowcase.
Really? Yeah.
And all the beans just fall out of the shell and are at the bottom of the pillowcase.
Oh, really?
That's the old school way.
You bang on it with a spoon or with your hand?
Or a gunny sack. Or
yeah, whatever.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, just bit with a stick.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
And it's faster than shelling it in the green shell stage.
Yeah. And they sound divine.
Yes.
Okay. Alex, as always, thanks. You're so enthusiastic, and your products are always so nice and fresh, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser. And today he's talking about his purple-hulled pink-eyed beans, which are similar to a black-eyed pea, slightly different flavor and texture, so definitely worth checking out. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Just a quick note about Thanksgiving. Once again this year, we're serving Thanksgiving dinner at Angeli. Like our Thursday night dinners, it's a family-style meal. We're doing two seatings at 4 p.m. and 6:30. The cost is $38 per person. It's a groaning board, to be sure. If you're interested, please call Angeli at 323-936-9086 for reservations. I just wanted to make mention of a great farmers market in Westwood on Thursdays. They've relocated to the Vets Garden area of the VA administration in Westwood, and they're noticing a real drop in business since they moved from inside Westwood proper. The market setting's really gorgeous, set amidst trees and lots of free parking. In addition to organic produce, you can see wild birds that were rescued from smugglers. The market's open from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. each Thursday, which is great to have a night market. It's located on Constitution Avenue at Sepulveda, just north of Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood. If you work in the area, it's a great way to stock up on fresh produce for the week. Now, the blender's got to be one of the best inventions ever. Those small blades can whip anything into a liquid form. It's like a bit of the metal shop made its way into the kitchen. There's a man who takes the most random things, tape measures, an iPhone, Bic lighters, and throws them into his company's blenders to see if they will blend. Of course, it's a YouTube phenomenon. Next, the man in the blender behind Will It Blend. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW. When it comes to using a blender in an unusual way, Dan Aykroyd and his Bass-O-Matic on Saturday Night Live is probably what we all think of, but not for long. The new star of the strange blend is Tom Dixon, founder and CEO of Blendtec. Now, Blendtec makes really strong blenders that hold up to pretty much anything you may imagine. Cheese? Of course. The can the cheese came in? Sure thing. Tom's a new YouTube star due to his unflappable nature in the face of power blending. Hi, Tom. I love your videos, by the way. I'm a fan.
Well, thank you.
When did you first start blending non-food objects?
Years ago, probably 14 years ago.
Do you remember what the first thing was?
Oh, do I remember. The first thing that I blended was a box of 250 wooden matches, and it blew up.
So the whole thing blew up, or just the contents blew up?
It blew the lid off the jar, and flames went up my arm, underneath my arm, and burned a hair under my arm, singed my hair a little bit.
And yet you persisted.
Yes. That was 250 matches.
You did do some Bic lighters recently.
That's exactly right, and that's reminiscent of what happened with the matches. And the first I threw one in, and it made a pop. I said, well, that's no big deal. I said, let's throw six in. And the fourth one, it blew up. And unfortunately, we only had one camera on the shot, but so you missed the whole big ball of flames. But it went, and once again, that went up both my arms, burned the hair under my arms, and singed my hair on my head.
How do you decide what you're going to blend next?
You know, Pete, we have literally hundreds of thousands of requests, but we walk through stores. Anytime I'm in a hardware store, I'm doing it. In fact, it's an obsession. It's really not good because you can't walk through something without wondering whether or not it'll blend.
Were you surprised by the response on YouTube of your blends? Did you first post them, or did people start posting them for you?
George has been with us about a year and a half, and he one day saw a bunch of sawdust in the demo room and asked somebody, what is all this? And, oh, that's Tom just goofing off again, you know, blending 2x2s. And so he said, I'd like to see next time he does that. And so, sure enough, he watched that. And then he, with $50, he went out and he bought some McDonald's value meals, some marbles and rakes and, you know, just various things, chicken and stuff that he found in the local store, and came back and we did 5 videos. And then he came to me 5 days later, and he said, we've hit a home run. We've had 6 million views in 5 days on YouTube. I said, WhoTube? I didn't even know what YouTube was. And then not too many months later, in January, I'm on the cover of the Internet Marketing Magazine. So believe me, I know what YouTube is now. But our sales are up, our online sales are up about 1,800%.
Unbelievable. Well, it sure makes me want one as a chef. Now, what are the blades made of that the blenders can blend so many different things?
They're made out of surgical stainless steel, and so very high chrome, very hard. But yet, because it's the speed, and they're running at a speed of around 260 to 333 miles an hour. And so no matter what it is, when you get hit at that speed, you know, something's going to happen. So,
for example, what happens to ice when it's blended at that speed?
Well, ice, you know, it's interesting because ice is actually blended at a very low speed. In fact, we can put over a quart of ice in the jar, and this is right out of the refrigerator, the harder the better, and in just seconds, on the very lowest speed, you have the most beautiful powder, fluffy snow. No cubes, no lumps, no bumps. It's just fluffy snow like we ski on here in Utah, powder. And so no other blender in the world can blend ice like ours does. Most of them you have to float the ice off the blade in water to make a slush or a slurry, and we actually make powder snow.
Now, you recently blended an iPhone. How long did that take?
The iPhone, maybe a minute. I don't know, something like that.
And what was left? Are any of these substances that are left after the blending kind of noxious?
Oh, yeah. Well, in fact, you can watch the iPhone. First of all, it's amazing. It was playing a video. It blew the back bottom off, the black plastic piece, and then the metal back, and it's still playing the video. Yeah, it smells horrible. You know, it's just the acid, the material from the batteries, and everything has a unique smell. The worst-smelling thing so far have been hockey pucks.
And why? Why do they smell so bad?
I don't know. It smells like cow pies, you know? That was one of the worst things.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. It's been really fun, and I can't wait to get my hands on one of your blenders.
Well, good. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and we'll talk anytime.
Tom Dixon is the founder and CEO of BlendTech, and more importantly, he's the host of the Will It Blend videos. It all began when he tested the blender by blending a wood 2x2. His marketing director started recording it, and the YouTube phenomenon was born. Go check out some of the videos on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. I think everyone can agree that a hockey puck isn't something you'd want to eat, but there's some argument about pig's ears and pig's feet. What some only feed to their dogs, others make a meal from. Next, a beloved English chef who turned bones, gelatins, and pig's parts into high-end cuisine. That's coming up next on Good Food. There are chefs that become the public's favorites. Then there are chef's chefs, those that welcome the highest esteem from their colleagues. That surely describes my guest, Fergus Henderson. His London restaurant, St. John, began focusing on food from nose to tail and everything in between. The scraps the modern-day eaters would cast aside, Fergus has celebrated. I recently got his latest book, Beyond Nose to Tail, and saw his devotion to unctuous potential. He's here to tell me what that is and what we've been missing. So could we start off by talking about trotter gear?
Happily.
What is it?
It's, like the name, it's unctuous potential. It's not a finished product in its own right. It's a helping hand to the cooking process.
So this unctuous potential, how is it made? What is it made of?
You take pig's trotters. I think you call them pig's feet here. And you braise them in chicken stock and Madeira for about 3 to 4 hours. So they're totally giving. Then you remove the flesh off them. And then you set that in the juices. So you have these lovely wobbly bits of trotter set in there in jelly. And then you've got this tool that you can braise, stew, use in any sort of form of cooking.
And it adds this intense, deep hit of flavour to whatever it's married with.
It's a delicious flavour. But it's lip-sticking without being kind of some reduction that's sort of too strong and overpowering. So it allows whatever it's cooked with to come to the fore. It's an encourager to the flavours that you're actually really cooking with.
And what about pig's ears? You have a lovely photo in the book, I must say, of Barbie with the pig's ears used as wings.
Yeah, she looks very fine, I think. Very fine. But pig's ears are interesting because they are kind of in principle cartilage. But we have come up with something that is very delicious in the book, which is the pressed pig's ear. Did you read that recipe?
Mm-hmm.
Would you set them in their own jelly? In fact, that seems you have the sort of give of the jelly and the slight crunch of cartilage. It works very well.
It sounds really, really lovely. Okay, now I have to ask, this is in regard to a dessert. Who is Dr. Henderson?
It's my father.
Is he really?
But he's not a doctor. But he did teach me this incredible drink, which is 2 parts Fenibranca, 1 part Creminwanth, which cures all known ailments.
That would take quite a somebody who really had an ailment to want to shoot that back. 2 parts of Fenibranca and 1 part of Creme de Menthe?
Yes, green. Green Creminwanth.
Describe what Fenibranca tastes like.
Well, I see. He's corrupted me, and so I rather like the taste of Fenibranca. It's a collection of roots and bark, and biggest user of saffron in the world.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you turn these two sort of opposing tastes—the barky, rooty, saffrony taste—and the mint of the Creme de Menthe into an ice cream.
Well, my wonderful Justin, a pastry chef, head baker, somehow managed to, yes, contain Dr. Henderson in the form of ice cream, which is a feat indeed.
You also mention another aperitif that you use to whet your appetite called a bicyclette. Could you describe it and tell us where the name came from?
It's Italian for bicycle, obviously, because old boys go to local bar, have a few of these bicyclettes, Campari white wine, and then wobble home on their bicycles. But it's very good, sort of gets the appetite going, the juices stimulated, and it's a fine thing. Sort of cleansing with a slight sort of medicinal overtones. Very good for the appetite.
That was English chef Fergus Henderson. His new book is Beyond Nose to Tail. I've got a link to the book and to his first commercial product, Unctuous Potential, which is made of pig's trotters, chicken stock, and other ingredients. If you were served pig's feet as a kid by your loving grandmother, chances are as an adult you'll have a yearning for them. For a Cuban child who found himself in Canoga Park at the age of 8, it was coffee he longed for. Next, a story of longing from one of the first Cuban immigrants to Southern California in the early 60s. That's when Good Food returns. We see again and again that what we eat makes up the fabric of our lives, fills the gaps in our memories, and connects us to who we are and the people we love. Eduardo Machado came to America from Cuba as a child. He's a playwright who's written a rich and beautiful book about his connection to his country and his family through food. Through all the upheaval in your young life, food seems to have been the thing that connected you and your family to the culture and to the past. Give me a couple examples of your favorite foods. Maybe coffee. When I think of Cuba, I definitely think of coffee.
Well, Cuba is the thing that made us feel the most Cuban when I was growing up. I started drinking coffee when I was 4 years old. And I would have coffee with raw milk brought in from my grandmother's farm that was brought in every morning. And they would boil it and put salt on it. And by the time I woke up, you could smell the coffee that was brewing and you could smell the milk. And I would run to the kitchen where I was served coffee and Cuban toast with butter, and that would be our breakfast. And I would do that every morning. Also late at night, like at 11 o'clock, we would have the same thing again. And then I couldn't sleep and they would wonder why I couldn't sleep. When we got to California, to Canoga Park, we couldn't find coffee. It was, 1961. It was before Starbucks. We just couldn't believe the thing that Americans percolated was anywhere near coffee. So my family went on the great coffee quest. And finally, like a year after we lived in Canoga Park, we went to the Central Market in L.A. and found Italian roast, which wasn't quite it, but was close enough. And, of course, my mother made it by taking a sock, filling it with coffee, and putting a little hoop around it, stitching the hoop around it, and then pouring hot water into the coffee because we couldn't find an espresso maker. So coffee became what made us better than Americans because we drank so much better coffee.
I'm intrigued by the addition of salt to the milk.
When I got older, I could never duplicate my mother's coffee. And it was only like 2 years ago when some students of mine who are Cuban that told me that the reason why coffee in Miami tastes better than Starbucks is because they never clean with soap the instruments. They only clean it with hot water. And once I started doing that, I got the coffee that I remember and taste in Miami and in Cuba. The salt just makes it both a little bitter and a little sweet rather than just sweet.
I love that idea. So you still do that now when you boil your milk for your coffee, you add a little
pinch of salt? Yeah, I put a pinch of salt. Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's so great. Let's talk a little bit about how you came. You were quite young.
I came when I was 8 with my brother who was 5, and we came on a thing called the Peter Pan Project. There was this rumor started in the Voice of America by an archbishop that had come to Miami from Havana, that they were going to take all the kids of the elite and sent them to Russia to become Marxists. And parents panicked, and like 17,000 kids were sent to the United States by themselves. My brother and I were a little luckier than most kids because my uncle was already there. So they took us in rather than going to, you know, terrible things like working for people in New Mexico or going to orphanages or Catholic private schools, you know.
What a nightmare. How long was it before you were reunited with your parents?
A year. And my brother was 5 years old.
Wow. So when they first came, there must have been a meal. There must have been some celebration that was marked.
Well, we spent a year eating Spam, you know, my brother and I. Not even Spam, you know, army rations Spam, because that's all that my uncle and his wife could afford. So I remember that my dad got a job cleaning cars. And with the first, you know, like $20 that he made, I remember my mother bought a chicken. And she made a very humble version of chicken and rice. But I remember really, really enjoying it because we hadn't had anything like that in a very long time.
Now, pork is a just central factor in Cuban food. What memories do you have once you were in America of using that pork, the roast pork, to sort of connect to the past?
Well, it was the only thing that connected us to the Chicanos because they had carnitas, which was close to roast pork. And, you know, in Cuba, porks were made either in the hole for a day and a half. Pork is what Cubans eat on Christmas Eve. And they would take them on a whole pork on Christmas Eve and have the bakers bake them in the oven. So everything was really crackly and delicious. But I remember us buying pork legs and trying, they were pretty good, but they weren't quite it because they could never get the ovens hot enough.
Growing up in Southern California must have been very strange because was there a very large Cuban community here when you were growing
up? No, we were
up?
The first Cubans to come. We were even in the Green Sheet newspaper. Our picture was in the front cover. So we were sort of alone there trying to figure out how to eat these things like zucchini and trying to find a white yam became a major project because we didn't know what to do with the yellow yams because we had never seen them. My mother really wanted us to keep being Cuban. So she thought the way to do it was by feeding us Cuban food all the time and by her figuring out how to get it the closest that she could.
Thank you very much. It's really a beautiful memoir. Very enjoyable.
Thank you.
Playwright Eduardo Machado's moving memoir is Tastes Like Cuba, An Exile's Hunger for Home. There are some recipes that become extinct or change because the ingredients can't be found any longer. And then there are recipes that were in favor many years earlier, and they've lost their place in the American kitchen. I'll be back next on Good Food to find some of these lost recipes and see what we are missing. Stay tuned. What is a classic recipe, really? Just because something is old doesn't mean it's necessarily good, does it? Well, Chris Kimball of Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen set out to find an answer to the question. America's Test Kitchen staged a lost recipes contest and were staggered by the response they received. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Tell me what you were looking for with the lost recipes contest.
Well, first of all, there's a reason a lot of recipes are lost. They deserve to be lost. Now, let's be honest. I've lost a lot of my own recipes on purpose. These are recipes that, for the most part, have not made their way into cookbooks or magazines. And they're recipes that deserve to be found. And so in the contest, we got almost 3,000 recipes submitted. We culled out about 10% of those just by looking at them and then made them all.
Did you have a caveat in the original contest that a story had to go along with the recipe? Because it seems like so many of these recipes do have great stories.
Yeah, I think of lost recipes as being short stories. There's a title, and then it sort of piques your interest in terms of the food, And as you read the story and read the recipe, you know, it tells a story. It came from somewhere. It came from Eastern Europe. It may have come from China. And then it changed over the years. There was a story to how it got to its present shape and condition and taste. Then finally, you make it and eat it. That's the last sentence to the story. It's the punchline. There's a wonderful recipe in this book called Wacky Cake. And there were many economy cakes during the wars, especially the Second World War. And people didn't have a lot of butter and eggs at the time. So it's a sheet cake. And there is no butter and there are no eggs. It has just a handful of ingredients. It's easy to make. You make little holes in the dry ingredients and pour in some vegetable oil and water. And you mix it together and throw it in the oven. And it's the most intensely chocolate, delicious chocolate cake you've ever had. So it tastes great. It's simple. And it's got a great story.
I noticed that there was something called a bologna pie.
Well, it was actually called Mile High Bologna Pie. And, you know, I saw
that
really recipe.
That's scary.
I know. I said, oh, boy. And it turns out, believe it or not, in the test kitchen that day we made it, there were no leftovers. I mean, it went. You know, I went down a couple hours later to taste it. It was all gone. So people actually really liked it. It was sort of like a, you know, chicken pot pie except with bologna.
Now, there's a recipe that sort of fascinated me because it goes against everything I've always been taught about baking, and that was the cold oven pound cake.
Yeah, I just made that, and it's a really interesting story. When gas ovens came around the turn of the century, they wanted to promote themselves, and one of the ways they did this from a marketing perspective was to say, gee, you know, they're so economical. You can even bake foods starting with a cold oven. So you make the batter, you put it in, and the oven's cold. And then you set the oven for 350 or 375, I can't remember which. And it cooks quite a long time, almost an hour and a half. And it comes out with a very nice crust.
Now, what about blueberry boy bait?
This was a recipe I heard of years ago. And in the Pillsbury Bake Off, I think in 1952, there was a teenage girl, I think her name was Rennie, and she came up with this recipe, which was really a one-layer blueberry coffee cake, and it had a streusel on top. And this is a common trick. They used to use the dry ingredients for the cake, the batter, reserve some of them, add a few more ingredients, and make the streusel out of it. So it was an easy way of getting a streusel. And it was boy bait, because this is how she attracted her boyfriend. Was making this great. I mean, okay, the sexist, silly 1950s, but it's a great title. The only recipe in the book that has a better title, in my opinion, is a dumpling. Well, actually, it's a cruller recipe. And the title is just killer. It's Naked Ladies with Their Legs Crossed. Now, I mean, how could you not like Naked Ladies with Their Legs Crossed?
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Chris Kimball, founder and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and of America's Test Kitchen. We've been talking about one of their latest books, America's Best Lost Recipes. More of these lost recipes can be found online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Do you have a favorite pie that someone in your family is known for? A pie can mean much more than a good crust and filling. It can say something about the person who baked it and who it was baked for. Next, a woman who thinks pies can be a true measure of a woman. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Maddie Pinner says that she was, quote, a descendant of that generation where a woman's appearance, manner, and domestic prowess were synonymous with feminine identity. Her book, Sweetie Pies, is a very sensual approach to pie, part cookbook, part memoir. The book is filled with anecdotes about the women in Patty's hometown of Saginaw, Michigan, a town she lovingly describes as very Mayberry-like when she was growing up, a town where the true measure of a woman's cooking prowess was determined by the quality of her pies. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Could you describe the first pie you made and what it symbolized for you?
Well, the very first pie I made, I think I was about 3 years old, and it was a mud pie. And I topped it with my mother's prized leaves from her rose bush. That was the very first one. And then I went on, I think, you know, the first real pie was an apple pie, and I probably was about 16 when I made that.
You know, there's so many colorful women that you feature in your book, including your mom, Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
How much of an influence was she in shaping your opinions about the role of women in society?
Well, my mother was very influential in shaping that. The kitchen belonged to her. She did all the cooking. She put the dinner on the table. But then she was also modern in the sense that she had her own income. She had rental houses. I think I got a little bit of both from her.
So what do you think pie baking represented for her and for some of the other women in your book?
Well, you know, for a lot of people, making pies is a really hard thing to do. And to be able to master making the crust and the filling and all that and putting that all together and having a good pie, I mean, that to me, or to them, I believe, represented the ultimate in housekeeping and homemaking and that sort of thing. You have to understand that it was a generation where just being a pretty woman didn't necessarily mean everything. You had to know how to cook and keep house also.
One of the things that I find really interesting about the profiles you have in your book of the women is that several times you'll say a certain woman had a reputation of being kind of fast, and others would say about her, there's no way she could be a good cook.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that this fast woman would get tired of carousing and she'd step back in the kitchen and make a beautiful pie.
Mm-hmm. There's my mother's cousin. We called her Sister Baby, and she, you know, was a fast girl, stayed out late at night, did a lot of partying and that sort of thing, but she could come home, take off her party dress, and throw on an apron and surprise everybody because she was a wonderful cook.
Do you believe cooking is the way to a man's heart still?
I do on many levels. I don't think cooking is the only way to a man's heart. I think cooking is one of the most intimate acts that you can do for a man, and I think it can touch him on many different levels.
You know, one of the women you talk about is Viola Trevant.
Trevant,
Viola Trevant, and she used her blueberry pie to sort of curry favor with her husband. Tell us a little about her.
Well, she was going through the change of life. And, you know, she was going through bouts of crying spells and that sort of thing. And her husband just kind of blew it off, you know, wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention. So that's where she started to touch him or, you know, to get his attention through her food. And so she, on the days that he wasn't paying her much attention, she just put a little broth and bread or something on the table. And when he started paying more attention to her and in her tribulations, she put more into the cooking.
She sort of used pie as a bribe.
She certainly did.
Yep, have you ever found yourself doing that?
Oh, I do that all the time. I do that all the time. You know, pies have personalities and they evoke various emotions. And with my boyfriend, you know, if I wanted something on the table to look sexy or whatever, I'll put a pie with a meringue on it. If I want to evoke this homespun feeling, then I'll do a big cobbler or something, but I do it all the time.
Do you ever take shortcuts, or do you always cook from scratch?
No, you know, I'm busy, and so I can't cook all the time from scratch, and I don't think we should feel bad if we use a box. Nowadays, those things taste really good. It's not just about the cooking, but just going through the motion of feeding someone.
Now, some of the pies in the book, for me, were really unusual in that they weren't based on fruit or nuts, but some of them were based on grains or even beans.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of share some of those? Like the oatmeal pie that I think was the Egg Lady's oatmeal
mm-hmm.
pie.
Mm-hmm. That was my grandmother's Egg Lady's pie, and my grandmother made that a lot and then passed that recipe down to us. To come home and have that smell in the house, that was just wonderful. It's just regular oatmeal that rises to the top and kind of forms a crust like a pecan pie, a very delicious pie.
So many of the recipes are recipes that I really want to try out this fall season. So thank you very much for giving that to us.
Thank you.
Sweetie Pies, an uncommon collection of womanish observations with pie, is Patty Pinner's book. I've got a recipe online for you at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you listened to this show a month or so ago, you heard me scare all of us over the use of plastic containers for food. Heat and soap on these plastics can cause dangerous chemicals to leach into our food and then into our bodies. The effects seem most severe in small children. So what to do? Everything has plastic in it. Well, I found a woman who went on a mission to replace all the plastic in her kids' lives. Her solution's next when Good Food continues. Recently, we've discussed growing concerns over our exposure to toxins in plastics. Plastic food storage bags, microwaving in plastic, drinking out of plastic baby bottles, saran wrap. The list seems to just go on and on. But what are the alternatives? Jenny Rask, a mom who's made great strides in eliminating plastics in her home. She's here to share some of the actual resources that she's found to help us make these changes. Hi.
Hi.
So let's just start. I'm going to throw out something that we use. I mean, I feel like my personal carbon footprint is all involved in plastic wrap and Ziploc bags.
Yes. I feel the same way. It makes me absolutely crazy. I probably like maybe a year and a half ago, I just decided to just drop all the plastic stuff, like sandwich bags, saran wrap, and try to replace it with other things.
Was it difficult to find things?
It is difficult. It still is difficult, but I think it's getting better and better. I think there's more products out on the market and websites that have like green products that you can buy that are alternatives to things that are toxic or, you know, just wasteful.
So did you go to look for biodegradable disposable items or to items made out of less toxic materials that are reusable?
Both. The biodegradable items that I do have in my house and that we're also putting into my daughter's school are, well, for one thing, garbage bags. Every time you throw out your garbage, you throw out a garbage bag, a plastic garbage bag. And I was just thinking, oh, this is just, I just feel really sick to my stomach about it, you know. There's different places you can get these cornstarch bags that are great. That
do they rip?
You know, they don't. I'm really surprised, actually. They are pretty durable, and they smell kind of funny. But other than that, I think they're great.
Now, what do you use instead of using a plastic sandwich bag or wrapping a sandwich or a snack in wrap, in cling film?
Well, there's several different things that I do for myself and for my kids. One of the things that I really like, it's on the internet, I guess you can get, and you can get some at Whole Foods, I think. They're called wrapping mats. They do have like a plastic liner, which they say it's food safe, but it's actually a cloth that has a plastic liner on the inside that's made out of PIVA. And you put your sandwich or your snacks in it and you fold it up and then you can Velcro it shut.
Yeah, it has a little Velcro attachment so it stays in a neat package.
It's great, yeah. And
so it's good for something that isn't super liquidy.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, that's something else. You're absolutely right. I do use some number 5 plastic containers for things that are liquidy. Other things like if you're talking about drinks, you know, clean canteens, really great. They're stainless steel canteens that you can just drink out of.
Now, what about Teflon pans? Have you made the switch from using nonstick pans in your house to something else?
Yes, absolutely. I kind of got rid of those maybe about a year ago, and I replaced them with iron.
Cast iron?
Cast iron and stainless steel.
And cast iron's great because you can't really wash it. So you don't have to. You have to just season it really well and then just wipe it out.
That's really funny.
So what other suggestions can you give us in our quest for not ingesting a lot of toxins? I understand that you use a universal nonstick silicone lid. What is this for?
This is for in replacement of Saran wrap. When you, let's say you make food and then you have leftovers and you put it in a bowl and you don't have a top for the bowl, these lids are great because they suction on the top of the bowl and it doesn't matter what size the bowl is and it fits on perfectly and you can just reuse it over and over again.
You know, it's so funny because I remember growing up that the refrigerator would be filled of like little Pyrex dishes with little Pyrex glass tops. It seems like we're sort of going back to an era where you just have all-purpose dishes that you can put things in instead of putting everything in a little Ziploc bag.
Exactly. So what happened? I mean, why didn't we just stick with that in the first place?
Oh, we love the new. We humans, we love the new.
Now we're just looking for stuff in the flea market that is like the Pyrex dishes that you're talking about.
Jenny Rask speaks to kids, families, and schools about waste-free lunches. I've got a link to her website and her company on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll also have a list of the plastic-free resources she mentioned today. Plastic toys are really popular for kids, but they can't beat out plush toys. Stuffed animals will never go out of style. There's a plush food show happening in mid-November. All plush toys made in the shape of foods. I'll be back to tell you more about it. That's coming up on Good Food. Do you miss hugging that favorite stuffed animal you had? Have you replaced that moment of comfort with food? Well, now you can combine your need to self-comfort. Stuffed is a plush food show of premier plush designers from 9 countries who are creating a meal of stuffed friends. Curator Sarah Jo Marks is vice president of DKE Toys, one of the largest designer vinyl and art toy distributors in the world. Hi, Sarah Jo.
Hi, Evan.
So before we start talking about the food aspect, let's just talk about these toys to give people an idea of what this sort of new generation of plush toys is all about.
Sure. Over the past few years, it's been very popular to make your own toys, and a sort of DIY culture has emerged, and people decided to make whatever made them happy. And in that case, we started to see things like roast chicken and toast and ice cream and donuts. And a lot of them have faces and are looking up at you and smiling and saying, take me home.
They're really adorable. Now, are most of these plush toys of this type, are they art pieces or are they production pieces? Can they be found in a lot of stores?
Oh, we're looking at both right now. So some of the things I brought here today are production pieces, but they're still made in limited runs and are highly collectible. And people can take toast and throw them on their bed or put them in a display case.
I mean, toast has arms and legs.
And a face.
And a face. So great. And then we have this really great sort of segmented white plush toy. What is this guy?
His name is Hello Maggot.
I kind of figured he was a little maggot.
He's a little maggot, and he's made by Shane Guile from Purple Flavor. And Shane came to us a while ago. Me and my husband run a company called DKE Toys, and he came to us with this idea for a maggot line of plush, and would they be cute? And we all agreed that they were very cute, and he suited them up in rat pajamas and bunny pajamas and started making funny maggots. And along the way, my husband said, "Do you think you could make a roast chicken?" And he said, "Yeah."
Are the purchasers of these plush items, are they buying for themselves to collect, or are they buying for children to play with?
Primarily to collect and to give as gifts. Because they're handmade, they're not guaranteed that a kid won't swallow a felt piece of butter or a button eye. So we say to give them as gifts, to be careful with them, and they really can be treated like pieces of art.
Let's talk about this show, which combines this world of food plush and actual food.
Plush shows have been going on for a few years now, and I have been collecting plush myself for a couple of years, starting with some very adorable plush donuts from So Dorky. And we wanted to merge the two things together and not just throw the food out in the store, but to put a table full of food with a turkey and make a whole meal. So curating the show became like organizing a potluck, and we didn't want to have too much potato salad and not enough coleslaw.
Now, is the food going to look like the shape of the plush toys, or are the plush toys going to look like the shape of the food?
The plush toys are going to look like food.
I love that. Now, you mentioned the name of a company, So Dorky.
Yeah.
That's the best name ever. Where's the exhibition taking place?
The exhibition is taking place at Monkey King on Melrose. It will be open to the public. The opening is November 15th from 7 to 11 p.m. And there will be stuff that you can purchase that night from our grocery store section and take home. And then the installation piece, which will be the dinner, those pieces will be available to take home after the show's complete.
Oh, it sounds like so much fun. So what are some of the pieces that we should look forward to that will be featured at the dinner?
I'm really excited about Frankenfoods from I Heart Guts. She's constructed a Frankensteak that looks like Frankenstein with bolts in his T-bone neck. And Kenta in Japan is making very uber-realistic sweets and cupcakes that will blow your mind. They're so, it looks like you could eat it.
What are the price points of some of the non-production custom plush items?
Well, that makes it even more fun. The price point is ridiculously low for the amount of time and effort that these plush designers put into making this stuff. Anywhere between $10 and about $100, you'll be able to take something home and enjoy it on your own table.
Oh, that sounds so great. Well, thank you so much, Sarah Jo.
Thanks, Evan.
Stuffed, a plush food show, is taking place at Monkey King on Melrose in Hollywood from November 15th to December 2nd. I'll have more info on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood, plus tell you all about the opening reception on the 15th. Now for some real food. I've got an amazing condiment made from 50 garlic cloves that you can make at home. Yes, I said 50 garlic cloves. Get ready. It's next on Good Food. Cooking with garlic. I mean, what can you do cooking without garlic? You have to always have garlic. And with us this morning to give us some new ideas for cooking with garlic is Eric Gower, the Breakaway Cook. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Evan.
So tell me what your default use of garlic is.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it an evolution, but I've sort of morphed along the years. And I used to be a pretty heavy garlic user, and I would use it in all kinds of things. And then maybe what I was using wasn't fresh enough. I'm not sure, but there was always a kind of slight aftertaste, and I was trying to think of ways to use garlic that would sort of reduce the the acridness of and the sharpness of garlic. And what I came up with, and this is not just me, but it's an old traditional recipe, is a garlic confit. And that just means any confit is just anything that's sitting in a bunch of fat, essentially. And it's not really cooked in fat, but it's stored in fat. And if you take about 50 cloves of garlic and you put them in a small shallow pan and you cover it with olive oil, usually about 2 inches of olive oil, till all the cloves are garlic, peeled cloves are covered, then you put it on the lowest flame you can possibly get, the lower the better, and for about 45 minutes, just let it sit there in this low heat, and then you just transfer it to a jar, and what happens is the garlic gets very, very mellow and creamy, and it's absolutely delicious, and this is my default garlic now. It's the only one I use.
So do you actually peel all your garlic cloves or do you buy peeled garlic?
No, I do not peel them all. I'm blessed to have a Korean grocer down the street from me. To call him a garlic fanatic would be a great disservice because this guy's out of his mind about garlic. But he has these wonderful bags of hyper fresh, I mean, just peeled garlic for like, you know, $1.50 for about 100 cloves. One of those bags gives me two batches of this confit of how I do it.
Yeah, I have to say that in our local Korean markets, that's where I always go to buy my peeled garlic because mm-hmm. then you know it's going to be super fresh. It won't have yeah. the beginnings of the sprouting in the middle.
Or the brownness or the sliminess or any of that.
Exactly. You know? And so you'll have less of that really weird, acrid
yes.
sort of bloom that happens.
And I think that's what makes people's breath smell as well. I'm convinced of it.
I've heard that if you keep garlic in an oil solution like that and it's not acidified at all, that bacteria grows. Is that something we should be concerned about?
You know, I've heard this many times, and it is not something I'm concerned about. I think it's the Clostridium botulinum or something like that. It's the foodborne bacteria that causes botulism is what you're talking about. But, you know, any bacteria can grow in an anaerobic environment. That is to say, it's oxygen-free. So if you're packing something in oil, there's no oxygen that can get in there. So it's by definition, anaerobic. But I don't know. I think if you're worried about it, one way to deal with it is just you would give the garlic pieces a very brief bath in some boiling vinegar, and that would definitely do it. That's what they do in Greece. You know, garlic is this panacea, you know, famous since ancient times, right? I mean, it possesses all kinds of curative and preventative properties that people talk about, have been talking about for millennia. It seems highly unlikely to me that garlic confit could make you sick.
Now, once you have it, once you have this beautiful collection of confit cloves of garlic, give us a couple ideas of how to use it.
It's unlimited how you would use it. You would use it exactly as you would use other garlic. You can chop it finely. You can leave it whole. I love it just whole in pasta. I think it's delightful. So whatever pasta you're serving, toward the end of the sauce you're making, I'll just take the jar out of the fridge and I'll plop 5 or 6 whole cloves into the sauce. And, you know, people just bite into those whole cloves like that and they go, oh, my God, I've never tasted garlic like that. It's sweet. It's mellow. It's just it's absolutely delicious. So however you would use garlic, that's exactly how you would use this confit.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Eric Gowers, the breakaway cook. He's got a wonderful site that I link to our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Plus, we've got this 50 garlic clove recipe there for you. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest videos of Good Food, and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Charlton Thorpe. We'd like to thank Jessica Spaulding for all her help on this show. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.